morning.
Good morning.
What a lovely treat to be welcomed by that piece, which is by a Puerto Rican composer. Thank you, Catherine, for being so mindful of that kind of thing. A six-year-old girl in nice clothes stands alone in the city of Tbilisi, Republic of Georgia. Strangers approach her to inquire who she is, if she is all right, where her parents might be. Later, the same girl, now dressed like a ragamuffin, stands in the same spot. No one approaches her. She is ignored by the passersby. The scene switches to a restaurant, where the girl, once again, neatly coiffed and dressed, takes a seat at the table of strangers. She is welcomed with questions of concern and invited to partake in the food. Same girl, again in the role of street urchin, enters the same restaurant and sits at a stranger's table. She is shooed away and eventually is asked to leave the place. At the public library, watching the video again in silence, I am appalled. A person walks to the area where I am sitting. I can't tell if it is a man or a woman. As he or she approaches, it becomes evident that it is a man, or is it? He or she is dressed in what strikes me as clownish clothes, with red leggings under multicolored short pants. His or her hair is dyed pink, and he or she wears an earring. What in the world? I think, is this a transgender person? I ask myself. What could possibly possess someone to show him or herself in public looking like that? Is my last silent question before I am struck by the irony. Why was I able to empathize so readily with the little girl and censure the callousness of those who shoot her away, only to seconds later be unable to put all judgment on hold before this person whom I could not fit into an acceptable category? What is empathy? What are the triggers of empathy? What are its obstacles? One of the many understandings of this concept that I found through a cursory search in Google, my favorite, is perhaps the one attributed to Alfred Adler. Empathy is seeing with the eyes of another, listening with the ears of another, and feeling with the heart of another. In other words, empathy requires that we put ourselves within the frame of reference of the other. It would appear then that empathy is impossible without imagination. As a father and grandfather, it was not hard for me to imagine my loved ones in the place of the little girl in the video. And yet, would I be equally likely to empathize? That word is really hard for non-English speakers. Really, really hard. It's like the fifth bank. I don't know, what is it? You know. One of my nightmares is that I'm the receptionist at that bank. Empathy requires that we put ourselves within the frame of reference of the other. It would appear then that empathy is impossible without imagination. Oh, I've already read that. And yet, would I be equally likely to empathize with her if I had seen her in real life in the city of Tbilisi rather than framed within a video, particularly if the sight of street urchins were not uncommon in that foreign city? Is imagination enough, or is it rather only the prerequisite of empathy, necessary but insufficient? I believe that Frederick Buchner gets it right when he comments on the golden rule. And he says, If we are to love our neighbors as ourselves, we must see our neighbors. We must see them with our imagination as well as with our eyes. That is to say, we must see them like artists. We must see not just their faces, but the life behind and within their faces. Here, it is love that is the frame we see them in. Thus, it would seem that empathy is a form of imagination framed by love. But let us not be confused. We are not talking here about a sentimental, touchy-feely love, but rather about a kind of love that is a resolve, a will, a determination to approach the other with fairness, respect, and compassion. Now, is there anything new in this? Anything we don't already know? I dare say that many of us, if not all, have been brought up in one or another version of Christianity. As such, aren't we inheritors of a tradition that puts the other, especially the suffering other, at the very center of faith? Is there anyone here who would dispute the centrality of empathic love to the Christian faith? Why are we then, over 2,000 years after Jesus' witness, so far from living the golden rule? What part of love your neighbor as yourself have we not understood? How could this other-oriented faith devolve into indifference and cynicism? Worse yet, into the horrific display of hate by groups such as the Westboro Baptist Church, whose official website is, and I apologize, but it is their official website, GodHatesFags.com. Note how hate, the word hate, places itself between God and fags, between God and this other whom the members of this church cannot understand, whose very identity they have reduced to a four-letter word, in whose place they are unable to put themselves. There is no resolve here to stand before the other with fairness, respect, and compassion. Now, even presuming the best of intentions, there are still important obstacles to empathy. A first could be the insufficiency of imagination, the literal incapacity to imagine ourselves in the place of another. Another could be what I would call the reduction of the other, be it by belittling or even demonizing, thus depriving the other of all nuance, all complexity, all mystery. Reduction can express itself in many guises. When we dismiss an individual by reducing him to or her to a certain class, race, or group, we are indeed belittling that person, depriving her or him of all nuance and complexity as an individual. Muslim, black, white trash, hick, fag, spick are only some of the labels at our disposal for this reduction. Argentinian philosopher-theologian Enrique Dussel can help us to understand the error involved in depriving the other of mystery and complexity. In his book, The Philosophy of Liberation, Dussel invites us to distinguish between the concepts of world and cosmos. Cosmos refers to the totality of that which is or exists, regardless of whether we know it or about it or are even capable of knowing it. The concept of world, however, is everything that is or exists within the horizon of our culturally determined and personal reality. Everything that we know or think we know is the concept of world. To the average person, quarks, muons, neutrinos, the elusive Higgs boson are all in the realm of the cosmos, although within the horizon of understanding of a few nerdy physicists. Everything that we can see in this room is part of the realm of our world. Should we transport the room in its entirety to some distant place and bring into it a group of natives who had never had contact with our world, they would most likely feel like they have entered a bizarre, exotic, mysterious realm. To them, this room would belong, at least initially, to Dussel's concept of cosmos. Building on these understandings of cosmos and world, Dussel reformulates the concept of metaphysical or transcendental as referring not to that which lies beyond the cosmos, but rather to that which lies beyond or transcends our culturally and personally defined world. In the arena of theology, then, the metaphysical or transcendental is not that which lies out there in the vast, perhaps unknowable reaches of the cosmos, but that which appears to us from without our world. Our encounter with the waves of immigrants that spill on our shores is such a transcendental, metaphysical moment. They come from without, and we don't understand their language, their religion, their dress. We try to retrofit them into our categories, and we don't like the resulting inferences. We are all too familiar with the ensuing tensions and misunderstandings. Dussel looks to his Christian faith to ponder the spiritual significance of such encounters. For a faith that affirms the mystery of the incarnation, of a God who adopts the frame of reference of humanity, a God who empathizes with humanity to the point of becoming human being, such encounters are indeed metaphysical or transcendental. He refers to them as the epiphany of the other, and affirms that there is not a more metaphysically pregnant occasion than this one. In other words, everything is at stake when we come face to face with another human being. God is not to be found out there in the unknowable edges of the cosmos, but rather much closer in that very difficult to bridge horizon beyond our cultural, personal, or internal world, beyond the self, beyond the ego. Another obstacle to empathy might be the opposite of reduction. It might be the magnification of the self. Before another human being, regardless of culture, ethnicity, gender, faith, we must struggle to understand that he or she is every bit as real as we are, and we must act accordingly. It would appear then that empathy would be out of the reach of the narcissist. Psychologist Eric Fromm makes this clear. He says the selfish person can see nothing but himself. He judges everything and everyone from its usefulness to him or her. He is basically unable of love. End of quote. Thus, to the narcissist, the self is the measure, the criterion, the filter of all reality. Narcissism is the ultimate magnification of the self. The narcissist is blinded by the clarity with which he perceives everything. There is no mystery to ponder. There is no hesitation or reticence to consider. There is no introspection, because the narcissist has no doubt about the self. The self is the measure of all things, a measure applied without hesitation in the appraisal of the other human being. Now, before we gleefully rush to identify all of the narcissists that we know, including the one that you were thinking about, be advised that there is, at the very least, a little narcissist in all of us. In all of us. To use Peggy McIntosh's metaphor, we all carry an invisible knapsack in which are packed all kinds of norms, views, and assumptions about ourselves and others, as well as unexamined privileges. And this knapsack strongly sways our very perception of other human beings. The anecdote about my bewilderment before a person whose gender I could not perceive should make it sufficiently clear that there is in my knapsack a norm of sorts that makes binary sexual identity a requirement for perception. I was unable to see this person without turning alternatively to masculine and feminine nouns and pronouns. This norm that I carry almost unconsciously in my invisible knapsack reduces an androgynous self, an androgynous other, to an optical illusion. You know how optical illusions, you'll see something as one thing first and then as another, but you cannot really see the object? I could not see the person. How can I empathize with a person whom I can't even perceive adequately? I am again reminded of Buchner's words, "If we are to love our neighbors as ourselves, we must see our neighbors with our imagination as well as with our eyes. That is to say, we must see them as if we were artists." There are many, many forms of otherness, and thus many occasions to test our capacity for empathy. This is not just an issue of ethnicity, religion, race, or gender. It seems to be a human condition that may well reach way back to our tribal past, or even be rooted in the very origin of the self. Isn't the other, after all, the looking glass for the construction of the self? Don't we always define ourselves in opposition to the other? No, the other does not have to come from an antagonistic group or from some exotic culture. The other can even be our brother or our sister, as attested in the ancient story of Abel and Cain. My doctoral dissertation, which I am going to read now, was a theological reading of four novels by Haitian author Marie Vieux Chauvet. Many who asked what I was writing about were bewildered by the information conveyed in what I just said. Some asked, "From which Haitian country?" And I had to clarify, Haitian, as in Haiti, not Asian, as in China or Mongolia. Others, like a group of young Dominican students, and you know that the Dominican Republic and Haiti share the same island, well, others like this group of young students whom I met at an academic conference in Quebec readily understood what I meant by Haitian, but could not conceal their amazement at the notions that Haitians could read and write at all, never mind well enough for anyone to study their literature. During the research process, I discovered that there is in Haiti itself a hierarchy of color that entails all sorts of privileges and prejudices. The ideal in this hierarchy is to look as white as possible while still having black blood. Ironically, it is these black genes that entitle you to an identity as a Haitian. In Haitian Creole, the word for man is neg, which is the same word for Negro. So they use the same word for man or Negro. Regardless of the role black genes play in the very identity of a Haitian, however, the ideal carried in their knapsacks is light skin and straight hair. You may imagine thus how offended the elite light-skinned mulattoes were during the American occupation between 1915 and 1934, when the invaders failed to distinguish them from ordinary blacks and to allow them into their social clubs. Yet many of these light-skinned mulattoes could readily turn around and look at their darker brothers and sisters with contempt. There is an anthropological basis for the lack of empathy. It can be rather dizzying, this capacity of ours, to turn around and look at a person with disdain while being ourselves at the receiving end of someone else's contempt. It would seem then that the knapsack we all carry is not some secondary addition, but rather an integral part of our very humanity. Addressing the issue of white privilege in a long, thoughtful response to a white friend who would like to know what white privilege really means, Lori Lakin Hutcherson, editor-in-chief of Good Black News, produces a list of examples. One of these is related to her experience as a young black girl who has just been admitted to Harvard University. She identifies three separate encounters with white strangers that still annoy her to this day. And here it goes. The first was the white doctor giving me a physical at Kaiser. Me. I need to send an immunization report to my college so that I can matriculate. Doctor. Where are you going? Me. Harvard. Doctor. Oh, you mean the one in Massachusetts? The second was in a store looking for supplies. I need it from Harvard's suggested what to bring list. Store employee. So where are you going? Me. Harvard. Store employee. Oh, you mean the one in Massachusetts? The third was at UPS, shipping off boxes of said what to bring to Harvard. I was in line behind a boy, a white boy, mailing boxes to Princeton, and in front of a white woman sending her child's boxes to wherever. Woman to the boy. What college are you going to? Boy, Princeton. Woman, congratulations. Woman to me. Where are you sending your boxes? Me, Harvard. Woman, you mean the one in Massachusetts? And I think, no, the one downtown next to the liquor store. But I say, gesturing to my labeled boxes, yes, the one in Massachusetts. Then she says, congratulations, but it's too late. The point here is, if no one has ever questioned your intellectual capabilities or attendance at an elite institution based solely on your skin color, that is white privilege. So you may think of yourself as the nicest, least racist, and most compassionate white person in the world, and maybe you are, but you will never stand in that line and hear the teller ask if the Harvard that you will be attending is the one in Massachusetts. Needless to say, blacks too carry their knapsacks, where one might also find unexamined assumptions about whites, Latinos, Asians, and who knows. However, and this is an important however, when what we carry in our knapsacks is supported and bolstered by power and privilege, a situation arises which often leads to abuse, exploitation, and manipulation of the other. And that is precisely why the call, "All Lives Matter," is self-evident and barely requires utterance, whereas the plea, "Black Lives Matter," is poignant and crucial. However relevant it may be to any conversation about empathy in this country today, the race issue is at least in the forefront of the national debate. But what about the social class issue? I find it interesting to note how this issue is almost a taboo here. It seems to run against our deepest sense of nationhood. You mention the social class issue and you're immediately a communist. This is the land of opportunity. What are you talking about? To speak of social class is counterintuitive in a country that holds as a self-evident truth that we pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. And yet the truth is that we need to be vigilant to the operations of class privilege as well as the operations of white privilege. Because there are many in this country and in the world, black, white, Christian, non-Christian, who carry in their knapsacks all sorts of assumptions and privileges that are simply not available to the poor. What sorts of unexamined norms, expectations, and privileges do we, residents of Western North Carolina, carry in our knapsacks? What kinds of encounters with others do we experience that would test our own capacity for empathy? One such encounter might be between locals and outsiders. To look at some of the historical photos available is to realize how much Western North Carolina has changed in the past 40 or 50 years. It has so much more to offer the visitor. When we look deeper into this development, however, we need to recognize that this change, with all of its attractiveness for outsiders looking for a better life or a better tourist destination, has led in many instances to a great deal of loss on the part of those whose family roots in this place reach deep into the past. As an outsider, I must try to be sensitive to this sense of loss. I must exert my imagination in order to empathize with those for whom the very reasons that brought me here have led perhaps to a feeling of dispossession. Yes, empathy is not easy. It is quite a tall order. However, in a world that seems to be getting smaller and smaller, with the epiphany of the other, of an ever more exotic other, is becoming a more frequent experience than ever before, we must cultivate empathy as perhaps our only real possibility of survival as a species. And this need for empathy goes beyond our fellow human beings. It must encompass the entirety of the planet. How then are we to proceed? There are no recipes, no 12 easy steps. There is no science of empathy that could stipulate clear rules to follow. Before this enormous challenge to see with the eyes of another, listen with the ears of another, and feel with the heart of another, we must practice a great deal of humbleness. We must realize that we are often at a loss to put ourselves within the frame of reference of the other. Sometimes we are too quick to speak, too quick to counsel, to give an opinion, when the only truthful thing we can offer would be a discreet, silent, respectful presence before the mystery of the other. What is more, we must strive to build a community of empathy. We must realize that the challenges and urgency of empathy cannot be met alone. And as a community, we must practice to stand in humbleness before the other, whether their otherness is based on the color of their skin, their gender, their ethnic origin, their social class, their religion, or whatever, recognizing that we may never really know what it means to walk in their shoes. But yet, there is another hazard in the practice of empathy. It's slippage into condescension, quite a stealthy operation of the ego, which makes us feel good and superior. We must be careful to realize that true empathy does not look down on the other, does not patronize him or her. Empathy is about recognizing in the other a bottomless reserve of dignity that calls first for all to respect and for putting judgment on hold. Yes, it is about seeing with the eyes of the other and feeling with their hearts, but it is also about allowing yourself to be approachable, even vulnerable. Empathy is about shared humanity. Allow me to share a personal anecdote concerning my son, who is a fourth, fifth grade teacher in New York City. A young Taiwanese girl joined his classroom in the middle of the semester. She knew absolutely no English and sat silently in class. Surely feeling isolated and intimidated by everyone and everything around her. Have you ever been in a room where everyone else speaks a foreign language that you don't understand? It comes through as a string of meaningless noises that you would be totally incapable of domesticating with spaces between discrete words, periods, commas, semicolons. It's just a brrr. So the same language that gathers everyone else in the room together into a community of understanding stresses your alienation and your solitude. My son, who had ventured earlier in his life into some Mandarin lessons, approached the girl and whispered, "Vo shi daole," which he tells me in Mandarin Chinese means, "I understand now." Two tears rolled down her cheeks. And thus began her integration into a new community of empathy and understanding. Pope Francis has recently made an impassioned call to a revolution of tenderness. What a lovely twist to a word, revolution, so often associated with violence and the spilling of blood. La vita non è tempo che passa, ma tempo di incontro, affirms the Pope. Yes, life is not merely about passing time, but it is rather the occasion to meet the other eye to eye in mindful, attentive tenderness. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. And while you're at it, you might as well applaud Catherine for the amazing stuff she does for us every week.